Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Our guest today is Glenn Paulos, and we speak with him about his bestseller, Never Sit in the Lobby, 57 Winning Sales Factors to Grow a Business and Build a Career Selling.
Oftentimes when customers were not fully engaged with you or whatever, they'd say, oh, you know what? Just send me a quote. Oh, just send me the data sheet. But we learned that if someone wanted a quote or whatever, you want to drop it off. Once there's the need for the quote, of course, you're never going to fax it because that's the first rule. But then how do you use that to be in front of the customer, right? I would say to the customer, oh, I'll drop the quote off. He'd say, just send me a quote. And I'd say, oh, okay, well, hey, you know what? I'm actually going to be in that area on Tuesday. I'm visiting another customer. I'll just drop the quote off. And he's like, oh, well, I'm really busy. And I'm like, that's no problem. I don't mind. I'll just drop it on the lobby. And he's like, well, okay, fine. If you want to drop it in the lobby, drop it in the lobby. So then next Tuesday, I would show up and the lady would say, who are you here to see? And I'd say, oh, I'm here to see Jack. And he's like, well, is he expecting you? They always say that, right? I'm like, yeah, he asked me for a quote. And she calls Jack. And Jack forgets about a week ago, we're saying, just drop it off or whatever. And he's thinking, oh, Glenn's in the lobby with my quote. You know, and there's a 90% probability he's going to come and get it.
Glenn Paulos is the co-founder, vice president, and general manager of Gap Wireless Inc., a leading distributor for the mobile, broadband, wireless, and test and measurement equipment markets. With over 3 decades of experience in sales, he has spent thousands of hours in the field or on the phone with customers and working with salespeople to help create several very successful companies. After entering the sales field in 1985 as a technical sales rep, Glenn founded his first company, MMWave Technologies Inc., in 1991 and simultaneously served as president of Anritsu Electronics Limited for 9 years. Using this extensive knowledge and experience in the industry, he lectures groups on sales strategy, consumerism, and what motivates people at the raw emotional level. Glenn lives near Toronto in Ontario, Canada, where he enjoys hiking, skiing, and playing pickleball. Now, on to this insightful discussion with Glenn Paulos. Glenn, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm delighted that you could make time and early in the morning and we are talking. I'm so happy to have you here.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Glenn, tell a bit about what you are doing. You run a telecom company. You're one of the founders of that company. Tell us a bit about your work before we dive in.
Yeah, I work for a company called Gap Wireless. I've been here for 16 years. The business, I'm the co-founder, I have a partner, but we sold the business in February of 2022. And we help the Canadian wireless carriers, you know, the cell phone companies, essentially build out their networks by providing them with technical solutions, everything from antennas and all the things you see up on cell phone towers and stadiums, everything that makes the network work. And as we like to say, there's a lot of wires in wireless. And and so that's what I do. We did sell the business and we both stayed on to help them grow the business some more for a few years. So now I'm part of a much bigger company, but I run their entire Canadian operation, which about 70 people. And definitely lots of fun and keeps me very, very busy.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah.
You wrote a book, which is Never Sit in the Lobby.
Right.
that's a very interesting and I think very appealing title for sales folks who keep waiting.
keep waiting in the lobby. It immediately sort of resonates of who you are targeting. I think it's a great example of great targeting by the title. What made you write this book?
So I started in selling about in 1986, and I worked for the federal government in Canada, believe it or not, a civil servant, as they call them here. It was a technical job. I went to school for technology, and but my boss told me I was in the wrong field and I should go into selling. So I quit my job. I got a job in sales, and I did love it. And I started to see a lot of behaviors from the owners of the company that I work for, and they were very good salespeople. And I started writing down the some of the rules that I would see them with behaviors. And so I would attribute these behaviors to them, and I would sort of give them a name, usually the name of the person I saw exhibiting the rule, and I would write it down. And I mean, I have to say from the outset, some of these are rules you want to follow, and some of these are rules you want to not follow, if I can say it that way, right? Do this, don't do that, right? And then I started repeating these rules, factors, as I called them, and you know, making people laugh, and you know, tell the story, get all dramatic, and people, you know, would laugh and go, oh my God, I can't believe that, or wow, that's a great idea. And then people heard some of these stories, and they're like, hey, could you come and share some of that at my sales meeting? So I started coming to talk to a few businesses, and you know, and then of course some people would say, oh my goodness, this is incredible, you should write a book, right? And of course I promptly did not write a book, and the years went by, and it wasn't until the pandemic, when I finally had to stay home at night and on the weekends, that I found the time and the, you know, just sort of the opportunity to pause for a bit and write the book. And so the reason I wrote the book was just to encapsulate all those years. You know, because by now we were from 86 to 2020, right? That's a lot of years. All those rules, I wrote them down. I wrote them down in the same book, actually, over the years. And I just decided to get it done. And it took about 9 months, but I got it done. And that's what happened.
Wonderful. So it took you about 9 months to write the book.
Yeah. Yeah, to write the book. Yeah. And then, of course, there was some editing and processes of editing and graphics and things like that, right?
Sure. So when you said, okay, I'm stuck at home and I have this book, and which is in itself quite remarkable that you had all of those written over a period of like 34 years in a single book, and the book was with you. That in itself is quite something.
Yeah.
So you said, okay, let me take this book. Let me look through what I've noted down and jotted down. And people have told me from time to time, I should write a book out of this. Maybe this is a good time to write the book. That's
exactly what happened.
Right. So now you look at this, you open this book, and what do you see? I mean, what are you thinking? Oh my God, I mean, this is too much, or how do I organize this? What really went through your mind?
Yeah, I definitely, at what you just said, that's what happened. I mean, I'm like, okay, how in the world do I do it, right? And so I did what I always do and what everyone does. I Googled it, right? How to write a book. And because I obviously had zero, you know, really knowledge. And I stumbled upon a podcast, and the guy on the podcast was saying, anyone can write a book. All you have to do is write 500 words every day until you're done. And so I thought about that, and I thought, you know, the way my mornings work, that doesn't really work. But if I take Monday to Friday, that's 2,500 words, and I do it on Saturday and Sunday, that I can make work for myself, right? And because I have a lot of in the mornings, I on Saturday and Sunday, I have personal time. And so, you know, I figured, hey, what I'm going to do is on Saturday to Sunday morning, you know, either or both, I will get those 2,500 words done every weekend without fail before I do anything else, right? And honestly, that's what I did. I just committed to writing the 2,500 words every weekend. And I mean, there's a bit of a joke where I wrote until I got to 75,000 words. And I thought, you know what? 75,000 words is perfect. I Googled how many words do I need in a business book? And it said 60 to 80, right? And I said, 75,000 is perfect. Then I sent it to the first editor and the lady says, Glenn, you can't swear that much in a book, right? And I'm like, oh, okay. And so I said, all right, delete the F word everywhere you see it. And she said, okay. And I said, we'll agree on 71,000 words, right? And so I mean, obviously it's a bit of a joke, but the story ended after first editing and, you know, cleaning up my language, it worked out to be 71,000 words that I had put on paper. So
that's interesting anecdote. I'm sure your readers will find this really amusing. So Glenn, you took these ideas that were in the notebook, either the do's or the don'ts. I mean, you noted it down maybe in a couple of lines, maybe just as an idea.
That's right.
And you took it and now you expanded on that, right?
Right.
Now,
yes.
So two questions. Did you have only 54? I think you said 54, right?
57.
57. Sorry. My bad. So 57, did you only have 57 or there were many more and you sort of left some out saying, okay, these are not good enough or these are not important enough or this will get sort of subsumed into the other heads?
I had, I don't want to say a lot more, but I had quite a few more. Mm. And most of them I was able to write a chapter about. Mm. But some of the chapters got removed for them saying, you know, the readability was getting affected, like the story was maybe too convoluted or, mm-hmm. you know, although the message meant something to you, it might not mean the audience might not resonate with the thought or. And so the first editor, a lady, she cut out a fair bit of that copy and content, I guess you should say. And so I can't actually recall exactly how many, but there were quite a few that she chopped. And and some of the stories she forced me to rewrite from different angles, like to change the, to maybe, although some of them do talk about people, I changed their name, of course, but she had to depersonalize some of the stories as well for readability and stuff. So yeah, there's more of them. And of course there's, so, when you start selling in the 80s and all the way to today, right? Like, you know, the old boys network and all that, some of the stories can be fairly colorful or as they say, you know, now not safe for work. Right. And so some of the, you know, some of the language, some of the stories, you know, she trimmed out for modern, you know, the modern audience and right. Yeah. So, you know, and is there enough for a second book? Well, after everything I've learned in the last few years of selling my business or whatever, I definitely have enough for probably another two or three books, to be honest.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So did you sort of expand on these ideas? Like you said, you wrote them into a chapter. Did you do that based on where it originally happened and how you wrote that down? Or was it something you researched or you sort of connected your experiences to that?
Yeah. So it was kind of an either or. So a lot of the way I recorded them in the book, in the first notebook, you know, was the name of the person. So I could always refer back to who it was. And then essentially what I call the punchline, right? Which was the, what did I take away? I didn't write the whole, any detail. Right. It was just da da da, this and that, whatever, don't do this, something like that. Right. And enough that I knew that whenever it was, I would be able to remember the incident and reflect on the story. And so most of them were, you know, going to 2020, looking back, would be to me to retell the story in a way that I felt people would be sort of drawn into the, the sales call or the presentation or something and actually feel like they were in the room with me and experiencing what I experienced so they could learn the same lesson that I learned. Right. And then in a few cases, I had to actually go and become a subject matter expert on things. So I wasn't, you know, talking nonsense or BSing the crowd, you know, with what I thought was the right thing. So I had to actually learn about some of the topics I wanted to share. Most of it is stories from the past and good, bad, or indifferent. And a lot of them are lessons you do not want to repeat. I will say that. But the lesson is very clear when you read it, right?
Right. So Glenn, how did you arrive at the title? Who helped you get there?
So I really wanted the title to be something with the word factor in it, right? Because it's like always my factor, my this factor, my that factor. And, you know, and to me, that was, I just owned that title so much. Like, I didn't know exactly what the title would be, but I mean, like I said, I wanted to have the word factor in it. And I did come up with a title that had that word in it. And the editor sent it back and said, that's not the title. And I said, okay. And I always forget the order, but it's either content and then copy or copy and then content. But there's two sort of series of it. One, the second editor, also a lady, she actually suggested the title. And because the name of that chapter stood out to her so much, she said, you know, this is a perfect, you know, title that will grab you from distance. They have a science to it. I'm not exactly sure. It's my first book, but this lady had a lot of experience and she said, look, I recommend, you know, you don't go with that wordy title you came up with, but rather something, you know, more punchy. And she helped me to come up with it. And I just thought, you know what, that's perfect, because I say that a lot, never sit in the lobby. Yeah.
Good one. So let's get into the book.
Sure.
You start with a chapter on never fax the facts or ship the ship. Yeah. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So before you tell me what that is about, I want to know, how did you decide to sort of structure the book in terms of what goes first, what goes next, and so on? So was it something you had clear in your mind that this is how it should flow?
Well, for transparency, I had a long series of chapters and stories, right? Yeah. And I tried to have a cogent grouping of them. But when I got the book reviewed or whatever by the editors and stuff, they said it didn't flow very well. Mm-hmm. And so I hired another editor who helped me to structure it in a way that were these packages of concepts. And honestly, like, they did such a good job. I mean, and it looks so obvious to me in the end, but I'm thinking, why did I come up with that? But I didn't come up with that. And they really grouped it into a series of, you know, kind of like, and it does flow, right? Like when I talk about some of the chapters, it really just makes sense with this one, this one, this one, this one. And then, or then you've kind of moved to a different state of mind. And then these three, you know, come along. And,
sure.
And so, yeah, I mean, I had helped to group them in a way that the audience would see a really good flow, because the stories occurred at such different points in time. In my mind, it was more of a linear 1985 to 2020 progression versus, you know, being in front of the customer, getting in front of the customer, staying in front of the customer, relating to the customer, building rapport, you know, that kind of thing. Right. And so they helped me to group them into those packets of concepts so that each section, you know, was better. And it was also done in a way, one of my goals was that you could literally have the book sitting there and not force the person to read it like a system where, you know, you got to start chapter one is on this. I wanted you to be able to pick up any chapter and learn the lesson in a few minutes and put it down and pick it up again and learn another lesson. So each chapter does not have to be a prerequisite to the one that comes before it or read the next one in order to get something. They all stand alone as lessons to follow. And you know, and there's many, many, you know, like how to leave a voicemail. You can just go right to that thing, voicemail. You can put the book down and go back to your business, right? You know, in 2 minutes, you know, you've read the chapter and you're done, right? And and so that was one of the goals of the book too, was to be able to, you know, have it as a handy little reference to pick up and put down at any point in time.
Right, makes sense. So let's get back to Never Fax the Facts. What triggered that chapter?
Yeah. Yeah. So I made up that saying a long time ago. of course, a lot of people, the first people to review the book, they're like, oh, you know, you need to modernize that, right? Nobody uses a fax machine anymore. And I'm like, yeah, I run a technology company. I'm pretty sure I know nobody uses a fax machine. But I said the story and the lesson comes from a time when the fax machine came out. And, you know, and even if you read the chapter, you'll see at the end how I modernized the concept, right? And so what I had learned was never fax the fax, never ship the shit. So we were selling high-tech equipment. My whole life, that's what I sold, like things that are technology-based. A lot of it were instrument-based, where you plug it in the wall, displays, buttons, knobs, things that helped engineers do their job. I learned that oftentimes when customers were not fully engaged with you or whatever, they'd say, oh, you know what, just send me a quote. Oh, just send me the data sheet. Oh, yeah, we'd like to see, or we'd be talking about a demo, and they're saying, yeah, you know what, just ship me the demo for next week, and I'll have a look at it when we're doing the evaluation. That's shipping the product, right? Shipping the shit, right? Or back in the 80s, of course, when the quotes, when I first started in sales, there wasn't a fax machine, actually. We had to literally type it on three-part paper and rip it apart and send the one part to the customer and file two parts in our end. And we would mail the quote, and it would take like a week, right? But we learned that if someone wanted a quote or whatever, you want to drop it off. And in the book, you know, there's other little chapters that are attached, like I was saying earlier about combining them, where it's like, once there's the need for the quote, of course, you're never going to fax it because that's the first rule. But then how do you use that to be in front of the customer, right? And, you know, just to quickly to put some meat around that, what I'm saying is, you know, I would say to the customer, oh, I'll drop the quote off. He'd say, just send me a quote. And I say, oh, okay, well, hey, you know what? I'm actually going to be in that area on Tuesday. I'm visiting another customer who's in one of our systems. You know, I'll just drop the quote off. And he's like, oh, well, I'm really busy. And I'm like, that's no problem. I don't mind. I'll just drop it on the lobby. And he's like, well, okay, fine. If you want to drop it in the lobby, drop it in the lobby. So then next Tuesday, I would show up and the lady would say, who are you here to see? And I'd say, oh, I'm here to see Jack. And he's like, well, is he expecting you? They always say that, right? I'm like, yeah, he asked me for a quote. And so now I've got something in my hand, something in my mind, right? And she calls Jack. And Jack forgets about a week ago, we're saying, just drop it off or whatever. And he's thinking, oh, Glenn's in the lobby with my quote, you know, and there's a 90% probability he's going to come and get it. And then, of course, he comes and gets it. Then it spins off. The other thing about the shipping of the shit part is that, you would ship them instruments or what have you, and you would come back to get it, and you'd see that there was a week worth of dust on it because they never even opened the box. And so my thing is, you have to deliver something. If a customer wants something physical from you, your job is to deliver it, set it up, make sure they know how to work it, and then figure out a way between the beginning and the end of the trial to go back and make sure they're using it and they're getting the value from it. And I mean, I never sold these, but I give a really good one about a tow motors, forklifts, you know, in warehouses, you know, and how I got the CEO to come down to test drive it. And I mean, it's a bit of a fable, but the message is very clear how you can make it work with anything. And so that's why I never fax the fax and I never ship the shit. I always deliver it. And, you know, again, later in the book, it shows you how you use those techniques to build your next call and your next call and your next call so that you're not having to work as hard to figure out who you're going to visit, because your boss wants to know who you're going to see today and, you know, how many calls you're going to make. And so the easier you can stack calls every day throughout the weeks, you know, the easier your job becomes, because you're just always in front of customers and each meeting builds on the next, right? And
absolutely makes sense. Yeah. Let's move on and talk about the power of three. What is that about?
Sure. So the power of three is, so that's like, you know, the Goldilocks principle, right? You know, too hot, too cold, just right, you know? And then also when you think about things like when you look at deals on flyers that come in, good, better, best, right? It's not good, better, best, and super good, right? Or super best. I mean, once you get past the third one, it breaks down and people start getting confused, right? And so the power of three is that, you know, it's a proven concept that people resonate with being presented things in a way where there's an alternative choice, mm-hmm. but limited to three. You know, two's not enough, three's perfect, four's too many, right? Mm-hmm. And so in the book, I relate to many, many different ways that, mild, medium, hot, you know, like there's so many ways things are presented, you know, in terms of the power of three. Mm-hmm. But also, I on my website, I have a little brochure document you can download that's called The Punch, Perfect Pitch, and Close. Which can teach you how to do the perfect presentation, and inside the perfect pitch part of the presentation, you know, is the power of three, where you're presenting three things. If you have to present four, there's too many. You have to have two, more than one meaning. And if there's only two, then you need to expand on your thoughts to put it into a more of a three pack power of three type approach, right? And the presentation itself is also based on the power of three. Tell them what you're going to tell them what you told them, right? And so if you when you break it down to its most common pieces, you know, the three, you know, three is your friend, right? And except when it comes to making sure customers heard you, then it's seven, right? If they've never heard, they don't really hear you until they've heard you seven times. Sure. That's also a rule that's in the book.
Sure. So you say in a chapter that follows, hear me now, believe me later. Right?
Yeah, hear me now, believe me later. I love that. I actually say that a lot, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of more, you know, it's not so much a like a rule on how to do things or what have you, but it's basically a way to communicate with people that are close to you or staff that are close to you, mm-hmm. and where you want them to pause and take note of what you're saying, right? Like sometimes you'll come in and, you know, you'll want to share something of a good news nature with your boss or something, like a customer's doing something that's exciting. And the problem is that, you know, you tend to ramble and maybe start off with too much backstory and people's minds wander and they're kind of thinking, get to the point and things like that. But so what I always use the hear me now, believe me later is basically, look, what I'm going to be telling you is important. You need to listen to it. You may not believe it now, but later you will realize that what I was saying on that moment is important. And so I use it to like focus people and say, look, hear me now, believe me later. What we're going to talk about right now is important. So-and-so is starting a new technology, da-da-da-da, it's going to be big. There's going to be money behind it, this, that, or the other thing. I want your attention. Even if technical, give me the time because I believe it'll important. And later you will substantiate that it was a good investment of your time. And that's what I mean by that one.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break,
you know, let's say you need your boss to invest in something in order for you to present a sale or whatever. You can say, look, you know, hear me now, believe me later. These guys will be spending $500,000 to $1 million on this factory upgrade. And I need us to fly in the guys from overseas or whatever. I need to bring in the Brig machine. We need to do that's where the hear me now, believe me later comes in. And it's used to make the conversation shorter. And it's basically like, hear me now, believe me later. These guys are spending $1 million. We need to do a demo and we need to get in there in the next 2 weeks.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful, and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it.
I'm also thinking of trust, right?
Yeah.
I mean, sort of I can stretch this and say that how do you use this, unless you have something else later in the book,
right?
How do you use this to build trust with the prospect or the customer?
So a lot of times the hear me now, believe me later, you're using it with your people that you on your team, right? And not so much in front of the customer, right? Okay. Because with the customer, you're kind of making an assumption to say, hear me now, believe me later. Like, and they're like, oh yeah, that's what they all say, right? Mm. Moreover, it's like, you know, let's say you need your boss to invest in something in order for you to present a sale or whatever. You can say, look, you know, hear me now, believe me later. These guys will be spending $500,000 to $1 million on this factory upgrade. You know, and I need us to fly in the guys from overseas or whatever. I need to bring in the brig machine. We need to do a, you know, that's where the hear me now, believe me later comes in. And it's used to make the conversation shorter. And it's basically like, hear me now, believe me later. These guys are spending $1 million. We need to do a demo and we need to get in there in the next 2 weeks. Right. And then these guys like, okay, what do you mean? You know, this and that, right? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, going in and going, oh, I was in there and they were going on and, you know, the guy, he's so successful. He's a PhD and, you know, he's working on this new technology, you know, blah, blah, blah. And of course the boss is like glazing over and he's not hearing any of it. And, oh, and then I need you to fly in the guys from, you know, overseas to do the demo. And then he's like, you know, so I use it just to sort of establish credibility of like when you said the trust, what I was thinking was I know these people, they know me. And I'm saying, look, when I say hear me now, believe me later, I'm asking you to trust me that it's important. And I need you to listen because what I'm going to say is important. And later you'll believe me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah. I get it. In fact, I sort of thought of it, but I was not thinking of internal discussion so much.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the prospect and the customer.
Right.
And it's also, it's sort of in my head, it works out pretty well because I can say, look, you may find this unbelievable, but hear me out and you'll see it'll make connect with you going forward.
Exactly.
So don't debate right now. Just listen to me.
Exactly.
And you'll figure it out eventually. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, you can use it with a customer, but I mean, oftentimes, and I think the examples I probably give are probably more related to, internal teams, you know.
I get that because I think just like the buyer has a buying committee, especially if you're selling things like what you're selling. I mean, these are expensive machines and things which are not easy decisions. Obviously, it comes with multiple people being part of it. It's not that it's not like a $50 SaaS. Like,
no, exactly.
Swiping your card and buying it, and if you don't like it, you know, stop paying for it and so on. Like this is $100,000 or $200,000, or $500,000.
Exactly.
So these things. So what it's also triggering, as you explain, is that I think we should also be mindful about a selling committee. It may not be visible.
Right.
There are multiple people that you need to take along as you are building a solution for your customer, because you need support from, whether it's customer success or the technical team or your boss, whoever it is, that yes, I can sell it at this price. I can offer him this additional things and I can guarantee him that we'll be in business for the next 10 years and we'll be able to support it and so on and so forth, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So let's go to the rapport building chapter. I mean, I know I'm jumping a bit. I'll come back to others. But I think it just to connect as a thought. Continue. Sure. What are we talking about there? Yeah.
I really love the concept of rapport building and talking about, like, you know, when once rapport is built and what have you, and you've done your jobs correctly in selling and what have you, then you don't need to close the customer. The customer will ask what the next step is, right? Because they want to buy, right? And there's all, I'll stay on task, but there's other chapters in the book that talk about how you build them to resonate with your product and want it and close themselves, right? But so rapport building is, you know, the concept of it, and I used it as recently as yesterday with someone, and I said, look, regardless of our core values in our business, our core concept and our core, you know, our core value, which isn't even stated, is that we want to be a pleasure to do business with always, right? We don't want to be a pain in the ass supplier. We don't want to be difficult. We have many competitors that the customers reflect back on us that they're a pain in the ass to deal with, right? You're a pleasure to do business with. And I go, well, that's the way we design the business from the ground up. Mm. And a lot of it is on building rapport, right? You know, and I mean, there's different topics in the book about rapport building. You know, of course, one of the most effective ways of building rapport is active listening. The other one is more of a humorous chapter that I give you called implied familiarity also mm-hmm. breeds contempt. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a saying, you know, an English saying called familiarity breeds contempt, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, lots of people, if they've heard the saying, they know, it just says it all in the three words, right? But I realized something in selling that this concept, which I call implied familiarity also breeds contempt, right? Because the first one, you know, the original one is basically when you spend a lot of time with a certain individual or whatever, after a while, you will become contemptuous about certain things. Like they might click their, you know, they might click their teeth a certain way over and over again. And the first time you hear it, you don't even hear it, right? But then, for instance, if you're sitting there for 4 hours on a train with them or something, you know, that clicking sound will sound yeah. like a gun going off after a while, right? So sure. loud, right? And you become contemptuous of it because it becomes hyper familiarized, right? Mm. But what I realized was when people go into customers and they make an implied sense of familiarity with the customer, and the story that I tell is about going into a customer and seeing that behind their desk was a picture of the man holding a fish and with another guy, right? Mm. All proud and whatever, and saying, "Oh wow, I didn't know you're a bass fisherman. That's amazing. You know, I love fishing. You know, maybe one day we should go fishing on the weekend. You know, I love going to whatever, you know, Lake Kuchiching, and you know, the bass fishing is amazing." And the guy looks behind him and he sees the photo. He goes, "Oh my God." He goes, "You know what? That's actually my ex-father-in-law. My wife and I are divorced. I never liked that guy. She would always browbeat me to go out fishing with him. As a matter of fact, I hate fishing." You know, and he takes the photo off the wall. He goes, "I forgot that was there." Takes the photo off the wall, throws it in the garbage. And now I've created a huge sense of contempt in this guy with, "I'm a part of it. I'm a fisherman," right? And all because I implied that I'm familiar with him and what he likes, right? Mm. Rapport building would be more naturally of saying, "Oh, what's the story behind that photo on the wall?" And he'd say, "Oh yeah, thanks for reminding me to get rid of that," right? Or, you know, "Oh, I'm fishing," yeah, "this and that. I love fishing. I compete in bass, you know, whatever," right? And so there's all a series of chapters on different aspects of rapport building. Yeah. But I do believe that, you know, people they kind of like expect rapport and that it's there, but it has to be built up over time.
Yeah.
And so many of the rules are the bricks that go together to create a wall of rapport with the customer, not a wall in between you, but, you know, just a metaphor, you know, you have to build it up one brick at a time and, sure, or one step at a time. And, a simple one at the beginning of the book for in rapport building is, you know, never forget a face. Right. And, so.
Nice. Nice. So what's the David Gleason factor? I think that's the only title which has factor in it, by the way.
Yeah, I know, they took it out on me. They took it out. Yeah. So David Gleason, that name is changed to protect the guilty. Okay. So, so quite honestly, he's actually referred to in several chapters, but I didn't want to overuse his name. Or what have you, but the David Gleason factor, the most likely the one in the book where I've actually named it after him, was the one where he was a competitor of mine, and I looked up to him as being a very capable business person and something that I strive to become later. And, you know, he was older than me, and I had started my first company in 1991. And I wished I could have a company that looked like his company, right? And and he was selling vendors from around the world, and I was building a company where we were signing up vendors. But I mean, I had the B and C type vendors. He had the A vendors, right? And I thought, oh, if I just could just sell some of these lines, you know, I'd be set, right? And I mean, eventually, you know, I went to all these trade shows. Of course, all the A level, B level lines were already signed up in Canada, and but eventually, I was able to convince one of his lines, just talking to them at a show, to, you know, basically terminate their relationship with him and sign us on as their representative company in Canada. And I thought I had won the lottery, and oh my God, I'd freed up a line from him. You know, and they said, you know, we're no longer happy with that company. We would, you know, we're looking for a new partner. And so later at the next show, I turned a corner, and I was walking down one of the aisles of a trade show. And at the other end, walking towards me, was David Gleason, right? And he was, you know, he was sauntering for me. There's no way I could back out of the hall. And I was embarrassed because I thought, oh, he's going to be mad at me that I stole his line and this and that, right? And eventually, of course, we came together. He knew me. I knew him. I said hello. And, you know, and I actually said, you know, oh, I'm so sorry about, you know, taking, you know, such and such. I hope there's no hard feelings. And he goes, Glenn, listen, there's never, ever been a line that we sold that we lost that I actually wanted to keep. And that's all he said. And he said, have a good show. And he just walked off. Right. And I think, what? And I realized, like, no, I mean, the only reason I got it was because he didn't care enough to keep it anymore. Cause it wasn't worth having. Cause it was a has-been technology or also ran or whatever. Mm. Right. And I learned a valuable lesson. Right. And I mean, when things are important, you put in the time to keep them, right? Mm. When you don't, you become ambivalent, right? And I mean, there were a lot of you know, techniques and rules about him that I had learned over the years, and I credit a lot of you know, a lot of my success on some of the things I saw him doing, and I copied them. Yeah,
right.
So
interesting.
Yeah,
absolutely. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's talk about checking and leaving voicemails, my harshest lesson. What lessons are we talking about here?
So checking and leaving voicemails. Yeah. So that's a whole little schmidgen on voicemails. So the checking and leaving voicemails and how you do it is one concept. And then the lesson is kind of secondary, but tied together. So my harshest lesson was, this is more somber kind of story or whatever, but in 2004, you know, I was running my other company that I had sold, and I hadn't sold it yet, but and I was acting as the president. We were actually up to, like, I think 100 people at that point, and I had just gone through, like, a divorce, and I was not at my best, sort of, you know, running my best game. Okay. And so a salesman was asking me about something, and, you know, something, a technical point or sales point, whatever. And I said, look, you know, if there's any issue, just give me a call. If I'm not there, just leave me a voicemail. And he kind of, like, burst out laughing at me, like laughed at me. Like, I'm like, what's the joke? Right. And he's like, you don't know the joke? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Like, but I'm fine. I'm like, spit it out. What are you talking about? Right. And he's like, well, that's the joke itself, is like, you know, oh, just call and leave them a voicemail, because you never pick up the phone and you never answer your voicemails. So the only way for me to talk to you is to, like, literally find you in the hall. Right. Because when I call you, you don't pick up. And when I leave voicemails, you don't phone me back. And, you know, so I'm sorry to be the guy to tell you this, Glenn, but, you know, that's kind of a standing joke with you, is like, you know, you know, leave a voicemail. Like, and that tells the whole story with Glenn, like, yeah, as if he'll ever pick up his call. And I thought, oh my God, that's a horrible look, right? Mm. And I said to myself, and especially coming into my new business in 2007, that I will always endeavor to pick up the phone or phone them back, right? And if it's like a salesperson not related to me or whatever, I'll forward them to the, you know, hey, we're selling new freight services. I'll sell it to the logistics guy. If it's, you know, exchange rate people, whatever, I'll give it to the finance lady. You know, if it's related to me, I will make an endeavor. I'm not going to phone every single salesperson that cold calls me back, for instance, but, you know, the, you know, when customers call, whenever I don't allow a situation to call where I'm not communicating back to them.
Right.
And it was really a harsh lesson to learn that I was like a standing joke for a poor behavior that had become so, you know, so much so that a, like an inside joke had been created about it. And that's why I called it my harshest lesson. And I vowed not to behave that way going forward. And it stuck with me, well, to this day, to be honest. Yeah. So
that's a nice story.
Yeah.
Let's move on to this chapter and wrap up this discussion today with I need to add value, right?
So so HINAV, H-I-N-A-V, HINAV, right? And so again, this is a don't follow principle, and this is one of those ones, don't do this, right? And so this is a concept that I see in junior salespeople, and even senior salespeople or any kind of business person or whatever. And I call it HINAV or high need to add value. And so what happens is it's hard to, you know, like at this exact moment, I don't have an exact story to tell, you know, to give you an example. But basically, you're sitting in a group with six or eight people. There's a discussion, you know, and you know, the topic comes up about, you know, anything relevant, right? The boss says something about, oh, you know, we're hearing about ChatGPT all over the internet right now. And this kid over the corner goes, oh yeah, ChatGPT. And he just, I'm doing this and I can do that and this and that and the other. And then the guy's like, okay, thanks. You know, thanks for your input, Jack, or whatever. I just was saying it's something we need to look into, you know. And then, you know, and then the boss will continue on in his discussion and he'll talk about, you know, something completely different, right? You know, all the compression ratios on those machines are starting to, well, I've always thought about compression ratios as being the key to the effective running of the machines. And at every turn, they have to add value in order to feel, like they're contributing or can be respected. And it's not a good look. It's not a good look. The loudest or most verbose person in the room is rarely the smartest person in the room, right? And so don't confuse loudness or volume or amount of content with intellectual capacity or anything like that. Often the smartest person in the room is the quietest person in the room, right? And if you don't, you know, if what you're saying is not needed, then don't say anything unless you're asked, especially because eventually it starts coming across and people will resent you for just being, you know, constantly blathering on and doing a HINAV. And so I learned it from a perspective that I saw myself doing it years ago. And I thought, you know what? It's not a good look. And, you know, I prefer them to pull things out of me like, Glenn, what do you think about, you know, this concept or that concept? Or if, like in today on the internet, you know, what do you think about ChatGPT? I'm not just going to blurt it out, but if you ask me, I'll share what I know about it. Right.
Yeah. Right. Anything else in the book, which you think you'd like to talk about specifically, Glenn?
So if it doesn't come up, then I always like to try to remind people of the most important chapter in the book. If someone like didn't ask me about that chapter during the discussion or whatever, and that is you only get forever to make another impression. And everyone's like, wait a minute, that's not how that goes. That's not the saying, right? It's like, my mom taught me always to make a good first impression or something like that, right? I go, yeah, that's what my mother taught me as well. I said, but what you have to understand in business is that you're always making a next impression. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You know, whether you're having your lunch in the company cafeteria and you do or don't clean up after yourself, you're making an impression, right? Where boss walks by your desk and he sees that you're on Instagram looking at reels, and you know, you see him there at the corner of your eye and you flip over to the company CRM and pretend like you're working, you just left an impression. And I said, what you all, especially people that are aspiring to move up in a business and to, you know, advance in their career, always be making an amazing impression on people above you that can help you to move up in the world. You know what I mean? And for instance, if you're at a trade show, you know, the big boss is coming in that day. It's a little bit slow. Some of the salesmen are sitting in the corner on their phones, messing about. Stand in the aisle and look for customers and go engage with them. You know, go and talk to the application engineers or the product managers and learn about the products in the booth, but don't sit down. You know, the old McDonald's, time to lean, time to clean, right? Just always be on. And as much as you want to get lazy and sort of sit around with the other guys and check your phone or whatever, don't do it. You know, get out there, engage with the customers, pull them into the booth. This is just one example at a trade show, but it's really easy to visualize. And you'll be amazed that the boss later will be, you know, that kid, Glenn, I mean, that kid's amazing. Like, you know, what he's all about. He's in the aisle pulling people in. The product manager's like, oh yeah, I mean, it was great. He spent an hour with me learning about our new, you know, software gizmo or whatever, right? And so always be making a good impression, right? Because you're always making one, so it might as well be good. And, you know,
yeah.
And I really try to encourage young people to hear that message. Because oftentimes they think, oh, it doesn't really matter, you know, this and that, whatever, nobody cares, nobody's listening or that, but they are actually, and they're forming a series of collected impressions, which become their attitude about you. Right.
Yeah, it absolutely makes so much sense. Especially, I mean, I think it's also a very basic attitude that you need to cultivate as a salesperson. If you want to be a salesperson, and it doesn't matter what you're engaging with, the fact that you will engage all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Always be on. Yeah.
Yeah. Always be on. Always be on. It's not necessary that you're selling all the time. Engage with your product, engage with your team, engage with your customer, the customer's team, and so on and so forth.
I don't want to take too much time, but I mean, there's a chapter on how to eat at a company dinner, right? And people are like, why did you include that? And I'm like, because you're always leaving an impression. Mm-hmm. And when the impression is down the front of your shirt, that isn't a good look, right?
Yeah.
Being a poor dinner guest with important clients is not a good look. The boss won't respect you for that. So, yeah. I mean, So I even cover off etiquette, you know, company lunches, dinners, things like that in the book, right?
Yeah. So.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Couple of things that you said. I mean, if you sort of take the ability or the interest to engage with what you mentioned earlier about listening,
right?
These are all which will essentially move you towards becoming a better salesperson.
Exactly.
I mean, you can define it as a sense maker or advisor. Right. You cannot do any of these if you're not engaged or if you're not listening, and if you're thinking of, I mean, you mentioned about doing things which make the customer close themselves. In fact, yesterday I was doing an interview
with
another author, and I mentioned this, that, you know, when I do webinars, I tell people that the biggest myth, And I would like to know what you think about it. The biggest myth that we have perpetuated as salespeople is that we close deals.
Yeah.
And I said, no deal in history has been closed by a salesperson. Yeah. Every deal is closed by the buyer unless it's signed, there is no closed deal.
Exactly. You're 100%. That's right. That's it.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not going to happen if you're not engaged, if you're not empathetic, if you're listening. It all comes from your being able to understand. I mean, you come with your knowledge. Of course, that's why you have a seat at the table. Of course.
Yeah.
But beyond that, it's about you understanding the need, because that's what you're trying to fulfill, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? And in summary, you know, the book is basically 57 tips on how to act, get and stay in front of customers, right? And, you know, and eventually, and they will close themselves if you've done everything correctly.
Glenn, that was great. I'm so glad that we had this discussion.
Me too.
I'm sure your readers will find a lot of value from this.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.